May it please the court, counsel, my name is Suzanne Elliott. I'm here this morning on behalf of Mr. Todd, who is challenging his convictions under the federal sex trafficking statute. And the basis of his challenge is that Section 1591 does not criminalize all acts of prostitution. That's normally a vice left to the state courts, but rather those that are accomplished either by involving children, which is not the case here, or by force, fraud, or coercion. And it's that phrase that lifts a mundane promoting prostitution case.
Why don't you focus on, it focuses on knowledge of the pimp. It's not
correct.
What happens afterwards is what the pimp knows or is recklessly indifferent to knowing at the time he recruits the victim, and the victim is the prostitute.
That is correct.
It's quite an unusual statute. The prostitutes are the victims.
That is correct. Well, I guess the issue comes, Your Honor, whether at what point the force, fraud, or coercion is both a part of the pimp's mental state as well as how it relates to the Commercial Sex Act.
Well, you know, we know about Mr. Todd that he's a pretty violent character. He knows how he's treated prostitutes in the past. Doesn't he have a pretty good idea of how we'll keep these people making money for him?
Yes, but it doesn't involve the kind of force, fraud, and coercion that Congress anticipated.
If I understand it correctly, his rule with these three women is you've got to earn at least $500 a day for me. Is that correct?
That was one of the rules testified to, yes, Your Honor.
And how does he think that's going to happen?
Both he and the women thought that was going to happen by them committing acts of prostitution. His promise, and his promise was riches. That we're going to live the good life. None of these women.
Doesn't that sound fraudulent?
None of these women. They made a lot of money, according to the government. That was the government's theory,
But he took it all. There was no doubt about that, was there?
He took most of the money. I don't think there was anything fraudulent about that.
Stop at the fraud. If the promises to the women, you're going to get rich, he knows he's going to take it all.
No, he said, we're going to get rich.
That makes it easy.
He was romancing the women as well, and the promises were of a kind of we're going to live the good life. And these women, motivated by the good life, although probably incorrectly, went ahead.
And he has no intention of doing it once he gets them going. He's going to take their money, and they're going to live in a room and be ready to meet the next demand.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. But it's not the kind of force, fraud, or coercion that was anticipated by Congress when they passed the sex
act. Well, it's not what Congress anticipated. It's what Mr. Todd anticipated.
How do we know what Congress anticipated?
Because Congress made some rather extensive findings when it came to sex trafficking. And it's clear that Congress, as well as the comments of the congressman at the time the statute's being contemplated, is that the kind of sex trafficking that they were anticipating that the statute would target would be women who are brought from overseas, don't speak English.
That was a big element. But you know, I would say for the last decade, we don't look at legislative history if the statute is plain. And the statute is plain.
The statute, I think, is ambiguous. But assuming, I think it's force, fraud, and coercion. Knowing the force, fraud, or coercion would be used in a sex act. The government's theory here is to cause a sex act. The government's theory here is that all Mr. Todd had to do was know at some time in the future he was going to use force, fraud, or coercion with these women. When he met them. I think that temporal relationship is different in the statute.
What's the difference now?
Well, because the force, fraud, or coercion has to be related to a particular commercial sex act. It can't simply be that he's manipulative, that he's a liar, that he misrepresents how much money.
But each of these women, he causes them to be available to answer a call from a customer for a commercial sex act.
That is correct. And they were under absolutely no misapprehension about what they were doing. There was no fraud. There was no force. There was no coercion. In fact, two of the three of them had been prostitutes before. He was a vile character, but he wasn't particularly misleading about what they were up to.
Correctly, that you're not alleging that the government didn't prove that he had the intent. You're simply saying that the statute is ambiguous, and therefore the requisite intent it's not clear enough for a criminal statute. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that even under the government's theory, which is that you just have to have the idea in the future you're going to have to use force, there wasn't enough evidence here to prove that. Because the proof was that he didn't need force, fraud, or coercion to get these women to work for him.
But under the standard now, this went to trial, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Trial. So under that, you know very well what the standard is. We just have to find out whether there was any basis for any juror, basically, to conclude that the government was correct. Isn't that right?
Well, there was a halftime motion, so it's de novo review. But you have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the government.
Right.
And
exactly.
In my briefing, I think, made it clear, I think even under the government's theory and under the evidence submitted here, they didn't prove sex trafficking. They may have proved promoting prostitution, but they didn't prove sex trafficking.
But is that, as Judge Noonan indicated, I mean, I admit that this statute and perhaps even others in the United States Code are not a model of clarity. But it does seem pretty clear, though, that what you're really talking about is the state of mind of the pimp. That's
correct.
Really the question here. And when you look at 1591A, either has to know or in reckless disregard of the fact that by means of force, threats of force, fraud, or coercion, as described in another subsection, or any combination thereof, will be used to cause the person to engage in a commercial sex act. So if the pimp on day one sits down and says, I'm going to go in the pimp business, and I know that in order to get cooperation here, I'm going to have to threaten and intimidate and coerce and so on. If the government proves that, and there was a follow-on where he does things to facilitate like that, in this case where he had the assistant who helped list things on the internet and so on and drive people and so on, doesn't that fully satisfy what this statute says?
No, Your Honor, because I think that none of that establishes force, fraud, or coercion as anticipated by the statute. He met these women. He romanced them.
But this just simply says, does he knowingly or in reckless disregard of the fact contemplate that this is going to happen? I mean, that's the way I read it here.
And there was no proof of that. In every one of these relationships, he targeted women who were already...
That doesn't really matter, does it? Because we're not talking about what they were doing before. The question is whether he was going to use these things to get them to commit the commercial sex act. And the fact that they did it before or they did it afterwards, it seems to me, is irrelevant to the issue of whether he intended, either knew he was going to do it or was in reckless disregard of the fact that he was going to do this.
Well, I think it's very relevant to his state of mind because he picked women he knew he wouldn't have to force to do anything. They were already involved in prostitution.
Why did he treat them the way he did? I mean, there's a lot of evidence about some pretty bad stuff.
I don't think he's a very nice man, and I think he wanted to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But the women had family in the area. They all testified that they viewed this as a way to make a lot more money than they could make at legitimate jobs.
They also testified they were very afraid of this man. And in a couple instances, I think he choked one and he bunted him.
He did.
How much money do they make?
Well, the government, the restitution order, I think, is in the $300,000.
No, how much money did any prostitute make?
They said they made nothing. They said that he took everything.
Yeah.
He said that's what their testimony, that he took all the money. But
they're the victims. Realize that.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's fraud, isn't it? If they said you were going to live the good life, share it, and he kept all the money, isn't that fraud?
Maybe the first time, Your Honor, but after months of committing the prostitution, I don't know how they could be under any illusion that what he was telling them was fraudulent. I mean, was the truth. It wasn't fraud in that sense. They all knew what prostitution was about.
As a court of appeal, what role, if any, can sociological information that has been bandied about the way prostitutes operate and their relationship with pimps and so on, is there any basis for us to take that into account?
None. In fact, in the trial court, there was offer of expert testimony, which Judge Robart quite properly said was inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that if you're talking about the government's argument that we should take into consideration the vulnerabilities of these women, I think it's not in the statute, so no, you can't. But if you look at the cases that talk...
Well, I don't know why you can't, because that's certainly a factor in susceptibility to being defrauded.
All right, accepting that it could, in this case, the government did not prove any of those vulnerabilities. You know, if, for example, you're talking about a woman who's brought from Southeast Asia who speaks no English, whose passport is taken, who's lied to when she leaves her home country and says you're going to be a nanny, all of those evils that Congress talks about, and if you look at the involuntary servitude cases that the government has cited with where retarded people of limited intellectual capacity have been victimized. Maybe so, but even on this record...
You know, this goes on all the time. You know, it's going on in this city right now.
That is correct.
Young girls and young boys, they come from homes where they're treated horribly, and they run away, they come to the streets, and they're just targets for these pimps who know of their vulnerability, who know how to romance them and to get them into their clutches. Huh? And then all they become then is just property for them. And if they don't follow the dictates of this pimp, you know, they get beaten up. All those things happen to them. You know, we just didn't fall off a turnip wagon a week ago.
I understand that.
And this is something that's gone on for thousands and thousands of years. It's a terrible, terrible blot on our society. It's brought about by men who treat women lower than regard them in a lower class than cows or sheep or goats. So this is the history. So anyway, let's hear from the government.
All right, Your Honor. Thank you.
I mean, you probably know more about this than I do.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Yi-Ting Wu. I'm an assistant United States attorney. I was one of the trial attorneys that handled the case involving Jerome Todd. This case was about a man who exploited young women. And these women were ages 18, 19, and 20. He was 8 to 10 years older than they were. He took advantage of their station in life, so to speak. And I appreciate that the court recognizes that there was fraud here. That was one of the theories that the government advanced to the jury at the time of the trial. In addition to fraud, there was force and there was coercion. And the evidence that the government showed at trial was that the defendant used his co-conspirator as the example. That is how we established knowledge. That is how we established his intention. at the time that he recruited the first of these victims, Whitney Thorne. At that time, he had already been, the terminology is, pimping out his co-defendant. He had already beaten her when she did not comply with his rules. He had already shamed her,
called her names, right?
Kelsey Kirschman. So he had already used the force and the fraud.
You know, I think the government produced evidence, but some things I found it hard to accept as relevant. I mean, you convey the impression of Todd as a bad guy, but say he calls them bad names. That's not force. That's not fraud. It shows he's an ugly guy, but why do you cite that as evidence?
That, to us, was a way of humiliating them.
Okay, but is that force or is it fraud?
Well, there are three ways. It's not force or fraud, but it is coercion.
Why is it coercion?
Because they wanted to please him. So
they wanted to what?
They wanted to please him. They wanted to make him happy. That's why they gave him the money. They wanted him to love them. They wanted him to appreciate what they were doing.
And is denial of affection coercion?
Yes. That is one of the arguments that we made.
That
isolation, the denial of affection, that's what he was doing to compel them to do this work. The harder they worked, the more he would love them. So they worked hard to please him. But if they couldn't do it, he would debase them. He would beat them. He would threaten to beat them. Yes.
Not being affectionate isn't. But another point in the government's case that puzzled me was all the emphasis on his fear of competition from other black men. What does that to do with anything?
It's an interesting aspect.
What does it show? What does it prove as to his knowledge he would use force or fraud?
It was a rule that he imposed.
I know, but what does it show as to force or fraud?
That if they violated that rule, he would punish them.
What does that to do with causing a sex act?
Well, he didn't want the competition, which he characterizes other black men, them away.
I mean, it seems to me the government got away with, I won't say murder, but with showing a lot of irrelevant stuff. You've been talking here now, answering my questions for 2 or 3 minutes without answering it. The stuff about the black men had no relation to what you were trying to prove.
What was included in one of the rules. So it was the collection of
the
rules.
What difference does that make? The fact that he would punish people for irrelevant rules doesn't show coercion as to a sex act.
Are you saying that was part of the scenario of control? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
Yes, he imposed rules, and those rules may not make sense to us. I completely agree with Your Honor. It does not make sense to me.
Did he call them rules, by the way?
Yes, he did.
So he said to these women, look, we're going to have this great life, but if we're going to do that, you got to follow some rules.
Exactly.
And if you don't do this, you're going to be in trouble.
Correct.
And now, the relevant rule, which I think you ought to focus on, is you've got to earn $500 a day.
Correct.
And can you spell out what was the sanction if one of the victims failed to earn $500?
It's my recollection that Jamel Locken, who was the victim in count 5, she reported that one day when she came home and had not earned enough money, that he assaulted her and that he called her names.
Now,
he
was calling names. Doesn't make any difference. What do you mean by that? I mean,
pushing and shoving.
Okay, so it was a battery.
Yes,
so not an
yes,
assault.
Physical. Okay. Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So there was pushing and shoving and slapping. He was unhappy because she did not bring home enough money. So that is one consequence of violating a rule.
It seems to me, frankly, that the government's case was supposed to focus on his foreknowledge or his indifference. But you spent a lot of time sort of blackening his character and showing things he did which were very unpleasant and so forth, but they did not bear on what he must have known at the time he recruited them.
Well, if I could answer that question in two parts. First of all, with respect to evidence about his character and the way that he treated the woman, that may not be directly tied to their acts of prostitution. The reason why the government brought in that evidence was to establish a climate of fear. There are reasons why these women feared him. It may not necessarily be directed to their having to have sex with other men for money, but they feared that if they didn't follow his rules, such as the rule about having contact with other black men, that they would be beaten. They did not want to be beaten. They wanted to be able to go out and make the money that they needed to make so that they could give him that money, and then they would not be beaten. But so it was creates a climate of fear.
You have to show, though, that prior to the commission of the sex acts, the commercial sex act, that Todd either knew or there was a knowing disregard of the fact that he was going to use force, coercion, fraud to get them to commit these commercial sex acts.
Correct.
And for purposes of our review, we have to basically defer to the jury's finding unless there's just nothing to tie this evidence together. Is that right?
Well, the evidence is there. Right. And the evidence, again, is Ms. Kirschman. She was his first prostitute.
Right.
The way he treated her shows us that he knew could use force, fraud, and coercion to compel another person to engage in sex.
Do you want to review the evidence of force on her that he'd used prior to recruiting the others?
Yes. There was evidence that he used force on her prior to recruiting the others. In fact, each of the other three women testified that they observed him beating her, choking her, shoving her, and slapping her.
So they all knew each other.
They did not know each other, but they knew her. Okay. Because, so, for example, Ms. Kirschman worked for him for a year and a half. During that time, he recruited the victim in count two, who was Whitney Thorne. She worked for him from approximately February 2007 until June of 2007. She then escaped. She was able to leave him. He then recruited Whitney Eichler, who worked for him in July. And then she, as you may recall, her mother was desperate trying to find her. And so the police were able to assist in her mother locating her. And then in August to October of 2007, the third victim, Jamel Locken, worked for him. During that entire time, Kelsey Kirschman was his co-conspirator and worked with him as well.
Were there drugs involved in this?
There were some drugs involved in that. Some of those drugs, for example, with respect to Whitney Thorne, ecstasy, was used to help calm her down the first couple of times. And counsel is incorrect in noting that all of these women engaged in prostitution before they worked for Mr. Todd. Kelsey Kirschman had a job at Fred Meyer. She had just graduated from high school. She had nothing to do with prostitution. He introduced her to it.
What?
Same thing with Whitney Thorne. She had a job, and he had her leave that job in order to work for him as a prostitute.
Did he introduce any of these women to use of narcotics?
No, he did not introduce the use of narcotics to any of these women.
Were any of the women addicts?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Were any of them addicts?
No, they were not.
What role, if any, does the fact that, say, one of the women was engaged in prostitution before or after have on, if you will, the causal link? I'm inclined to agree with Judge Noonan that there's got to be some causation. The force, coercion, fraud
yes.
has to be, the, if you will, the proximate causation of their engaging in acts of commercial sex. So the fact that somebody was doing the commercial sex before and or after, doesn't that somewhat sever or at least attenuate the causal link?
It may attenuate in that we have the requirement of showing force, fraud, and coercion. Mm-hmm. So one of the witnesses, one of the victims, Whitney Eichler, actually gave a very good example of the difference between working for a pimp who did not use force, fraud, and coercion, versus working for Jerome Todd, who did use force, fraud, and coercion. She indicated in her testimony that for approximately a week, she worked with her friend, who she considered to be a pimp. His name was Drew. They shared the money. He didn't tell her where to go, how to act. He did not isolate her from her family. He did not tell her to call him constantly. He did not impose a monetary amount that she had to earn on a daily basis.
And I gather the government's position is that we're supposed to take this as kind of like a frame, a picture frame. If there's a frame over here with Drew and there's a frame here with Todd, and you can show that Todd used fraud,
force or coercion.
Or coercion to cause, there was approximate causation of this woman engaging in a commercial act of sex.
Yes.
What happened before or after is irrelevant for purposes of proving the elements of the crime in that frame.
Yes.
Okay.
That is our position, Your Honor. Now, this court has previously discussed coercion and exploitation, United States versus Musri, which is one of the cases that we cited in our brief, and considered that that coercion is as broad as includes psychological coercion. It takes into consideration a person's vulnerabilities. It takes into consideration their station in life, their age, you know, the extent that they can be exploited by the person who indentures them. And so this court has applied that to its broadest sense, that, and that's the same definition that we, the government, argued to the jury at the time of the trial. If the court would like, I'm happy to talk about the history of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act with respect to how Congress intended that this statute to be applied. But in, based on the comments the court made with respect to Ms. Elliott, I'm not sure that, that the court is particularly concerned with that, but I'm happy to answer any questions with respect to that.
Whatever you do, don't talk about an octopus.
I don't know anything about octopuses. So unless the court has any further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Just briefly, Your Honors, on the, in terms of the term coercion, it's defined in the statute, and so there's no reference to the vulnerabilities of the victims in the statutory definition of coercion.
What's the definition?
The definition of coercion is at 18 U.S.C. 1591 C2. Threats of serious harm or physical restraint against a person, any scheme or pattern intended to cause a person to believe that failure to perform an act will result in serious harm or physical restraint, and C, the abuser, threatened abuse of law or legal process.
This is the old definition, is that right?
That's correct.
Could Congress amend it?
No, this is the statute that was provided to me yesterday that I think we all agree is the current one. Am I correct?
No, I think I thought they provided the old one, but maybe.
No, they provided the correct one yesterday, Your Honor.
Correct one, yes.
Yes, that's the correct one. I'm quoting from the one I got yesterday.
Oh, it requires
just to be
serious
sure.
Harm.
Threats of serious harm or physical restraint to any person.
Go on.
Then any scheme, plan, or pattern intended to cause a person to believe that failure to perform an act would result in serious harm or abuse or physical restraint, or the abuse or threatened abuse of law or legal process. And I think if you look back at the congressional findings, which I know the government doesn't want you to look at, that's, you know, the threat that you'll be deported, that they'll take away your passport, you'll be arrested, that sort of thing. At any rate, we'd ask that the court reverse the three convictions challenged here and remand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good arguments, both of you. Those were very helpful.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to say every criminal defendant needs and has a right to a lawyer, and I think you took on a rather thankless task, but really it's to your credit that you took Mr. Todd as a client and you've done your best for him.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's it.
Well, you're on the CJA panel, right?
I am. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And
we still thank you.
Yeah, we still thank you. No.
I think it's a...
Oh, it's I'm the chairman of the court's Federal Defenders Committee, so and know, I've supervised those panels, and I know we have a lot of excellent lawyers on them throughout the circuit. Thank you. Thank you.
All rise. This court for this session stands adjourned.